Welcome, everybody. This is the office hours for week four, I believe, for Mises Academy class on Mises on Money and Banking. It is February 2012, and I'll turn it over to your guys' questions. Let me just give you a reminder for this upcoming week five lecture, which would normally be on Wednesday, February 29th. Remember, that's getting pushed back 2 days, so now it's on Friday, March 2nd. Okay, so as always, those of you who are here live, feel free to chime in with the comments. And also, just put them right into the regular chat box. Don't put them in the Q&A box. Okay, Jan says, I didn't quite understand credit versus fiat money. What's the difference again? Why fiat money unlikely to exist? And would Mises consider today's money fiat or not? Okay. So in case for some reason people haven't listened to the lecture, you definitely wanted to do that one this week where I walked through the difference between credit and fiat money, and that's what Jan's getting at here. So I think for our purposes at this point, credit money is not really a big deal. I don't know, so maybe I'm relieving you if I tell you that, like, you don't get why are we spending so much time studying this thing. It's not, I don't think, a big deal, but since Mises refers to it, you kind of would be lost if you didn't know what he was talking about, so that's why I went over it in the last lecture. Okay, so the definition, first of all, and then I'll do an application. So the definition of credit money for Mises, all right, it is, first and foremost, you know, what's the basic thing that then might be adopted as money, all right? Because, first of all, let's think of commodity money. What's that? Well, it's, first of all, a commodity. You know, it could be gold, it could be tobacco, cattle, whatever, right? So it's something that's traded in the marketplace that people use either as production or a consumption good. But then we say, oh, that thing also at the same time happens to be a medium of exchange that is accepted by just about everybody in the community. So that's why we call it commodity money. Gold is the obvious example. All right, so now credit money, what is that? The thing that it is, before we worry about whether or not it's money, the thing that it is, it's a claim. And Mises, I never see Mises using any examples besides it being a claim to commodity money. All right, so maybe in terms of the definition, it could be a claim to a steak dinner at your favorite restaurant or something. But I don't think, in other words, I don't think the definition of credit money insists that it has to be a claim on commodity money. But I think in order for the thing to be widely accepted, that probably is true. Right. So, but in terms of the definition, it is a claim. And it's also money, and meaning that claim itself is a medium of exchange that's widely accepted. So the thing, and there are a lot of the questions on the quiz this week for this, so just be careful here. So if you're listening to the office hours, that's part of the function of this, is to help you do better on the multiple choice. You want to be careful because you say, wait a minute, a claim on money, isn't that a bond? And so, no, credit money is not the same thing as a bond. And credit money is not the same thing as a money substitute. So there's differences. So a money substitute, remember, in the Misesian system, is it's a claim on money. That's true. But it's immediately payable, right? So it's payable on demand. And there's no, you know, nobody doubts that it will be honored. I mean, obviously people know there could be a world war or something or an earthquake, but in the grand scheme of things, people, there's no doubt that the thing's going to be honored. All right. So with the credit money, that can't be the case. So when we say credit money is a claim on money, it can't be an immediately payable claim that everyone is sure about. Because if it were, Mises wouldn't call that thing credit money. He would just call it a money substitute. And then if you're really up to speed, you know, if it's fully backed by commodity money 100% in the vault, then it would be a money certificate. And if it's not backed up, then it's fiduciary media. Okay, but those are both forms of money substitutes for Mises. Credit money is not a money substitute. I'm saying a bunch of true statements about the Misesian framework just to make sure everybody, in case you guys like have an intuition about something but you're not sure, then maybe I'm either confirming it or making you realize you were drawing an inference that you shouldn't have. So that's why I'm kind of throwing out true statements about the Misesian scheme here. Okay, so credit, back to credit money, you know it's not a money substitute. So you say, okay, so it's a claim on money. So what does it mean to be a claim? Let me make sure I'm not losing anybody there. Some institution issues this thing. So it's like a legally binding, or at least in commercial practice, everyone expects it to be the case, that some institution issues this piece of paper, let's say, that says the holder of this is entitled to us giving you commodity money, let's say. But the point is it can't be immediately payable on demand. All right. So let's say it's payable in the future. So now you say, wait a minute, it's a piece of paper that this institution issues that says in the future we will pay you commodity money. Well, isn't that what a bond is? What's the difference? Okay, so this gets tricky. If it's not used as a medium of exchange, then yeah, it's just a bond. Right? So if some institution issues a piece of paper that's a claim on commodity money that's payable at some definite point in the future, you know, they might say exactly 12 months' time, the bearer of this piece of paper will receive from our offices 100 ounces of gold, well, then that thing is a bond. And the institution that issued that could have auctioned it off up front for maybe, you know, 98 ounces of gold. And then there would be an implicit yield on that bond. All right, so what makes the thing not just a regular bond but credit money is that claim itself is used as a medium of exchange and circulates in the community as money. So it's not the same money as the commodity money. They're different, you know. It's not a money substitute, is my point, right? They're different. But they're both monies because they're media of exchange that are accepted in the community by just about everybody. So if you're having trouble seeing that distinction or getting what that means, that's the part in the lecture where I have an excerpt in one of the slides, and Mises talks about the 100 golden, and I might be mispronouncing that term, note issued by the Austro-Hungarian, I don't know if it was their central bank or their government or what the institution actually was at the time, but the Austria-Hungarian government issued both bonds and these things that were credit money. Okay, Jan's saying he didn't see it. And that's fine, Jan, your question's good, and it's good that I'm reviewing this, so hopefully when you read the slides, you'll see. But anyway, Mises is there. He's in context, what Mises is trying to do and what motivated him to make that quote, which then allowed me to elaborate on what credit money is, and it's not a bond, and it's not a money substitute, is Mises was criticizing the view, because there were some economic theorists who were trying to explain the purchasing power of commodity money by reference to its industrial applications, right? So they were trying to say that its value as money like piggybacks on the fact that it has these other uses. And that's what they were trying to, you know, that's how they were trying to explain its purchasing power, even when it was being used as money. And Mises was saying, no, you're totally dodging the question. It is a fact that people, once something is recognized as a medium of exchange, people begin to value it for that reason per se. And that's why Mises says, well, not so many words, that his theory of value allows for the possibility of fiat money. Okay, so that's kind of that's something I haven't stressed in the lectures, never even said explicitly, so let me just elaborate on that. So in Mises' view, something starts as a commodity, and then through the system or the process that Menger laid out so well, people begin to accept it for purposes of indirect exchange, because some goods are more saleable or marketable or liquid than others, and then people start, you know, the demand for those initially more liquid goods goes up even more because of their superior liquidity, and that just snowballs it. And then eventually, if it gets to the point where everyone in the community is willing to sell their goods in exchange for that one thing, well, then that thing is now money. So in that story, Mises is realizing once the thing becomes money, at that point, it's exchange value relative to every other good is higher than it used to be. It has to be, right? Well, at least other things equal. Because before, there was only a demand for it for use in whatever the particular industrial or consumption outlets were. But now, on top of all that, people in the community are using the thing because of its capacity to serve as a medium of exchange. So more people want to get it, and the people who were using it before now have another use for it. Right, so if everyone's trying to buy more gold or acquire more gold, other things equal, that's going to make the market value of gold quoted in any other commodity higher than it was back before gold was money. So now Mises is saying, so if you're, as an economic theorist, trying to explain right now the purchasing power of the commodity that happens to be the money, and you just try to do it in terms of its industrial or ornamental applications, you're not even trying. The issue is, how do we as economists explain the valuation, like the equilibrium market value of the money good? And there, I mean, you have to take into account the fact that it is money. That's probably the majority of its value. So because Mises recognizes that, that's what makes him think, you know what, it's theoretically possible there could be a good at some point where 100% of its exchange value derives from its use as a medium of exchange, and that meaning it's no longer a commodity, a normal commodity, or you know, just a standard commodity. And so that's why he says, oh, fiat money is theoretically possible, because he realizes you could imagine people valuing something simply because it's money. All right, so let me just spend a little bit more time on this because it's such a good question, and it dovetails so nicely with the last lecture I gave. What in practice would be a credit money? Oh, sorry, let me finish one little train of thought there. So Mises, when he's attacking the theorists who want to explain the purchasing power of money by reference to its industrial or commercial application, he says, first of all, you wouldn't be able to explain fiat money, and we know fiat money is theoretically possible. But then he says, even with credit money, your solution doesn't work. And I have like a counterexample. He doesn't use that word, I don't think, but he says, okay, we have clear-cut historical examples of credit money. So what that means is there were governments that pledged to redeem their notes, like, you know, perhaps issued by a national bank or a central bank, whatever. So they were claimed on the commodity money that at one point were money substitutes, but then because of a war or whatever the reason, they suspended redemption, right? So these notes, these paper notes are still out there in the community circulating, but it's not clear when the government is going to resume giving people gold or silver for those things. But people still think that's going to happen. It's just this is a temporary suspension. So that's what credit money, or that's the quintessential example of credit money for Mises. So it's a claim to the commodity money. So it's not fiat money, but it's not a money substitute because it's of an uncertain redemption. But it's also not merely a bond. And this was the quote that I put on the PowerPoint where Mises says, this thing with the 100 gulden note, that there were just regular bonds issued by the Austro-Hungarian government. And so he's saying if you looked on a given day at a bond that had the same nominal market value as the paper note, yet the purchasing power of that note, the thing that used to be a money substitute, would be higher than of the bond. And he says that makes no sense if you ignore the fact that the note is a medium of exchange while the bond isn't. You cannot possibly explain that. You can't, because what people were trying to do is they were trying to say, oh, well, the reason merchants and whatever still accept that credit money, what Mises would call the credit money, is because they think that at some point in the future, the gold or silver redemption is going to be restored, and so they're sort of just like, you know, looking into the future and then maybe discounting back and putting in an uncertainty factor, blah, blah, blah. And so that's why they thought people were selling their labor and their goods now for these pieces of paper, is because they thought ultimately they were claims to the commodity money at some distant point in the future. And that was the edifice upon which its current valuation was based. And Mises was saying, no, that makes no sense because that same institution is issuing bonds that will pay the same thing in the future at a specified date. And on top of that, those bonds are earning interest, whereas the paper notes aren't. The things that used to be money substitutes aren't earning interest. So he's saying that doesn't make any sense. If you're explaining the purchasing power of the things that used to be money substitutes and now I, Mises, am calling credit money by reference to the fact that people, you know, are sort of subconsciously factoring in when they're probably going to go back to being redeemed and you can turn it in for gold or silver, he's saying, well, that's, you can do this, you know, those bonds, the same deal. Now, incidentally, I don't know that the bonds promise to pay gold and silver. All right, so I would have to go research. But the point is, whatever it was that the Austro-Hungarian government was promising to give you if you had those money substitutes, Mises' point, well, that's what the bonds were doing too. Possibly what he means is, since the bond promises to pay the money of the government, if the government's now back in a period where it's restored convertibility to the precious metals, well, then that's the same thing. I think that's probably what the way to resolve that apparent conflict. Okay, so let me just switch it. I know it gets tricky. Let me just do it in terms of the United States and dollars. So if let's say right now, in 2012, a lot of people, for some reason, thought that maybe because they thought of Ron Paul or something, they thought, yep, you know, that was an aberration, Nixon going off the gold standard in 1971, and we think eventually the U.S. dollar will be tied back to gold. This is just a long few decades of, you know, this aberration from an anti-gold policy. So imagine if you thought the U.S. was in this period of credit money. And then so a theorist is trying to explain the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar by saying, well, we don't know when, but at some point the dollar is going to be tied back to gold, And so that's why people right now are willing to sell their car for 5,000 of these pieces of paper that have, you know, $1 stamped on them, is because they know at some point those things will be tied back to gold. So what Mises would say to that person is that makes no sense, because right now, let's say I have a car that I'm going to sell, the example you just said, and I have one guy come up to me, and he offers to pay me $5,000 in currency, you know, in cash, U.S. Federal Reserve notes. And I have another guy come up to me, and he hands over U.S. Treasury bonds that are, you know, 30-year bonds that right now have a market value of $5,000. So I'm not even, let's be clear here, I'm not even saying the face value is $5,000, that, you know, the government will pay you in 30 years $5,000. No, the government will pay you whatever, $5,100 in 30 years. I'm not doing the math right. Whatever the rate is, so that when you discount it back at the prevailing interest rate, today's spot price. So if the Treasury were to auction those bonds off today, they would be able to get $5,000 for it. And now, you're the guy selling the car, and you have the one guy giving you cash, $5,000 in Federal Reserve notes, and the other guy offering to give you U.S. Treasury bonds that right now have a market value of $5,000. To whom do you sell it? The vast majority of car sellers is going to sell it to the guy who has the cash. And if you just think about that, why? Because whatever it is you're unless you were going to plan on taking that cash and turning around and buying 30-year treasuries with it, it saves you time to get the cash. Because the guy who gives you the treasuries, unless, like I said, that was what you actually intended to do with the cash, was to turn around and go buy treasuries, now you can't go to the grocery store and buy something with treasury bonds. You can't pay your mortgage with it, right? So what you're going to have to do is go to a broker and give him the $5,000 in treasury bonds. They give me $5,000 in cash, so I can go do whatever I wanted to do with the cash. You see how that works? So it's kind of an odd twist there, because you're thinking, you know, it's sort of like the old joke, what weighs more, 100 pounds of feathers or 100 pounds of bricks? And people say, oh, bricks. We say, no, they're both 100 pounds or 100 kilograms if you're in Europe, right? So it's kind of a trick question. They're the same. So you might think, what would somebody prefer to get in a trade, $5,000 in currency or $5,000 worth of bonds? You would think, oh, they're indifferent because they're both. No, but that's not true, because of this issue of liquidity, right? Just like if your boss at your job, instead of giving you a paycheck denominated in dollars, what if instead he gave you, you know, some necklace or something, and he said, oh, just go take it down to the jewelry store and you can sell it to them, it's the same amount. You'd say, what? No, you're supposed to pay me in dollars or euros or whatever the currency is. Okay, so that's what Mises is getting at. And so if you just think through the implications of that, that's interesting. So if you were trying to explain right now the purchasing power of U.S. dollars by reference to the fact that maybe at some point, you know, Rand Paul would be president and would tie the dollar back to gold, and so then I could turn these U.S. dollars in for gold, well, okay, but then the same thing would be true with this 30-year bond. Because what is a 30-year bond? That is a promise from the U.S. Treasury that we will give you dollars. So if you think that Federal Reserve note is going to ultimately be tied back to the dollar or to gold, well, then the same thing is true of the Treasury. You know, it's going to pay you in dollars, which will be tied back to gold, and you're earning interest. So if the only thing that mattered to you were the link to gold at some point in the future, then that Treasury bond that's today worth $5,000. In other words, let's say you think the gold redemption is going to be restored 18 years from now, or let's say 30 years from now. The $5,000 that you have U.S. Currency 30 years from now, if you just hold it, is going to be 5,000 U.S. dollars, and you can turn it into the gold. The 30-year bond is going to be higher because if it has a price of 5,000 right now, it's going to have a higher price then because there was discounting to the interest rate. Okay, so that's what Mises is trying to drive home there, that you have to take into account the fact that people are more willing to sell their goods for the commonly accepted medium of exchange than they are for other assets. And if you ignore that, that's not just like a little complication. That is the essence of monetary theory, to explore that phenomenon. And that's what the whole thing of fiat money is. Fiat money is nothing but an asset that is valued because of its liquidity. It's not a claim on anything. All right, so sorry for spending so long on that, but that was a pretty important topic. Okay, Lewis says, last thing, Jan says, would Mises consider today's money fiat or not? I got to think he would. Lewis says, about the fourfold classification, could you suggest an order of relevance of the different kinds of use and exchange value? Well, I'm not sure. I mean, when it comes to money in contrast with other commodities, as we analyzed during the last lecture, would you say in both cases, ultimately, subjective exchange value is always derived from objective exchange value? And following the same pattern, is subjective use value also derived from objective use value? Okay, well, that one's easy. Yeah, subjective use value is for sure derived from objective use value. So for people who don't remember, just to refresh your memories, from standard value theory, as Mises discusses it, there's four possibilities, right? So there's objective versus subjective and use value versus exchange value. So objective use value is saying the significance that something has in terms of what it can do for you directly. So you're not going to use it in trade, but you're going to either consume it directly or use it in production. And so the objective use value is sort of talking about the various things that it can do. And so I think a way to think about that would be like to say, okay, what's the objective use value to me of a pig? Oh, well, I could use it to make bacon, for example, or I could use it to make pork chops or whatever. All right, so you're just trying to think through, or I could keep it as a pet. So that's the objective use value that you're thinking of, what you could do. Now, subjective use value is saying, in terms of my preference rankings, how do I fit, what's the highest valued use out of all the objective use values? All right, I think that's the way it works. So, yeah, you couldn't really even think about your subjective use value of something without knowing its objective use value. You have to know what it can physically do before you can evaluate how do I rank that possibility. So Lewis Mises does say something like, in a modern market economy with the division of labor being very advanced, just about everything on the production side is undertaken with exchange value in mind. So just about, all production virtually is guided by the fact of producers trying to do what's profitable. And if you think that through, that means they have to think about market prices and what things will fetch in the marketplace. So when the shareholders of automobile factories see all these cars coming off the assembly line, they're not looking at those cars saying, well, what could I do with that? I could go on a joyride, or I could park it in my lawn and let my kids use it as a, you know, jungle gym or something. They're not thinking like that. No, they're thinking, how much could I sell that for? And then what could I buy with that money? So they're looking at it and saying, what's its objective exchange value? And then what's the subjective exchange value, meaning what could I trade it for in the marketplace? And then how do I personally rank that thing that I could acquire with it? So just like with the pig, you might say its objective exchange value or objective use value is to turn it into bacon, and then how do I subjectively rank bacon against other possible things? With the exchange angle, you say, what could I trade it for ultimately, and then how do I rank that thing? So Mises says, in a modern market economy with division of labor, producers view just about everything in terms of its exchange value, because they're not going to personally consume or personally use in production, you know, the vast majority of the stuff that they're producing. They're producing it to sell it to somebody else. But having said that, as economists, theoretically, in terms of the price system and the coherence of the explanation, if you then ask us, okay, but where do those objective exchange values come from? Well, ultimately, that's going to lead back to subjective use value. Right? So the farmer who's trying to decide, should I try to produce more pigs or more horses or more corn or whatever, you know, my limited resources, what do I want to focus on? He's not going to think in terms of what do I want to eat for breakfast next year. No, that would be crazy to you know, especially if you have a huge farm. But no, what he's going to do is say, how do I generate the highest net income for my enterprise, and then I'll use that money to go buy whatever I want to eat for breakfast. It would be silly for me to conduct my farm with my own idiosyncratic tastes in mind. That's crazy. My farm is for the consumers, basically, and then I'll take whatever income, and then I'll enter the market as a consumer myself. But, so the fact that the farmer might like bacon or not has nothing to do with his decision as to should he try to expand how many pigs he's raising at a given time and bringing to market. He'll just say, well, no, is it more profitable for me to try to do that or for me to do something else? But then, so it's not his own subjective use value for bacon that has nothing to do with that decision. But if you're trying to explain, let's say he does decide, oh, yeah, the objective exchange value of a pig is higher than of a chicken, and so I'll pump my resources into trying to raise more pigs. But you say, well, why is that the case? Well, then ultimately we're going to be led back to the subjective use values for bacon versus eggs in the people in the community. So I don't know if that's answering your question, Lewis, but that's the way it works. But whereas with money, you sort of, it seems like you're hitting a dead end, even though you're not really. Because with money, you're trying to say, you know, okay, why would somebody exchange valuable things for this good money? Oh, because it has an objective exchange value, and then you have a subjective exchange value attached to that. So that's why I would sell my labor hours, give up my leisure for the money good. So, okay, but then what, you know, why do, what explains the objective exchange value of the money? And you can't just say, oh, it's because of the subjective use value that some people get from it. Because the subjective, you know, depending on how you formulate it, right, those two formulations, either there is no subjective use value of money, or you'd say its subjective use value is derived entirely from its subjective exchange value. So those are two different ways of formulating, but the point is there's no independent use value of money. The only thing people can do with it is use it in exchange. And so you see the apparent difficulty that provides. And that's what Mises solves in the first half of the book. Okay. Right, and Lewis is just following up, saying sometimes they get mixed up when trying to figure out which one is dependent on the other, objective and subjective values. Right, they kind of go around, not in a circle, but they feed on each other. So, I mean, fortunately, it's not, you don't have to worry that aren't we just moving around in a big circle, and how do you know that we could ever come to rest and explain it? Because we know full well we can derive equilibrium situation, you know what I mean? You can model equilibrium outcomes and have equilibrium barter prices. And that's, you know, the Edgeworth box, if you've done that stuff, or in a more verbal approach, you mean Bob goes through those things with the horse market and whatever, right? So we know we're not just chasing our tail, that even though the things feed back and influence each other, you can coherently explain a barter situation and what the equilibrium direct exchange ratios are. And then, but just introducing money, things get a little trickier. So just to give you an example, it feeds on itself, because what happens is when someone's evaluating a particular unit of a good, the thing that matters is what is its marginal utility. And that utility is based on its highest, the most preferred use, right? So for some given thing, if the best thing they can do with it is consume it themselves, then that's going to drive how they appraise it and how they act with respect to it. But if the best thing they can do with it is to exchange it, well, then that will drive their actions and their and how they evaluate it, right? So that's why there's that feedback loop there, that if somebody, you know, in other words, in order for something to have any exchange value at all in the beginning, there have to be some people who have subjective use value for it. So that's what gives it a little kick. And now, because those people have a subjective use value for it, they will be willing to trade for it because they might consume it. And then that, depending on the scarcity and all that stuff, gives rise to the possibility that it might obtain an exchange value. But then other people now, seeing that it has an objective exchange value, might in turn value it more highly because of its subjective exchange value. And so if there were, like, think of the POW camp. So initially, there's all these prisoners of war, and the Red Cross comes in and starts handing out care packages that had, you know, like a little bit of water, a little bit of whatever, vitamins, or, you know, some meat, whatever the heck, I don't know what they had in there. And then two cigarettes. And everybody gets two cigarettes. So in the beginning, from, you know, on day one, not even day one, you know, minute one, how do you evaluate that stuff? And it's all, there's no markets right now, and it's all subjective use value. So, well, objective use value, too. So if someone looking at the cigarette can say, well, I could stick it in my ear, that would be kind of funny. And a smoker, of course, would say, oh, I could stick it in my mouth and light the thing on fire, and that would be great. But a non-smoker has virtually no subjective use value for the tobacco. But now, because there's a subjective use value from other people in the camp, they're willing to trade away their meat for it, and now a market develops, and now those cigarettes have an objective exchange value. So the non-smokers who originally were going to just throw it away because they had no, you know, they attributed no marginal utility to it at all, now all of a sudden, oh wait, they will, because of the objective exchange value. Okay, so that's, you see how that works. So you just have to be careful, and that's the thing with von Bauer's book on basic principles of economic value, where he walks you through those sorts of considerations, and it gets kind of tricky. But with money, it's really tricky, because it seems like there's nothing to get the ball rolling. And that's why, where the regression theorem comes in. All right. Tom Miller says, in the section, The Problems Involved in the Theory of the Value of Money, Mises writes, if it had never been used as money, or if it had ceased to be so used, its present-day value would be determined solely by the extent to which it was known to be useful in industry. This is what Friedman and many mainstream economists predicted when the U.S. went off the gold standard. It was widely thought before that the price of gold would plummet. Obviously, it didn't. How do you think Mises would explain why gold increased in price? Okay. Great question. I think somebody asked me this last week. I'm not complaining. I'm just trying to – I know somebody asked me this, but maybe they did it on in the forums. I don't remember. But anyway, because there's okay, Lewis did. All right. Because there's even quotes where Mises is more explicit, Tom, where he – and maybe you just picked the one that was in front of you and you know what I'm talking about. But Mises elsewhere says something like, if gold were to be demonetized, its market value would plummet or something like that. And so it looks like Mises is wrong. So you're right. There were many economists – now, I'm tempted to say many Keynesians – which is a true statement. I mean, I've seen economists who don't like Keynesians showing predictions from guys like, I don't know that it was Samuelson per se, but it was people of his, you know, up there. Like, so recognizable names. I think it was Samuelson, but I'm not positive, so I don't want to say for sure it was him. And like John Kenneth Galbraith and guys like that, that, you know, modern Austrians and free market guys wouldn't like, put it that way, who were predicting that when Nixon took the dollar off gold, that the price of gold would sink below $35 an ounce because they thought it was gold linked to the dollar that was propping up the gold price, right? That nobody would, if you own gold, you would be a fool to sell it to anybody for less than $35 an ounce under the Bretton Woods system, because the U.S. government stood prepared to give you $35 in exchange for your gold, for your ounce of gold. So why would you sell to anybody for less than that? So they thought once the government took that floor away, the gold price would drop. Whereas in retrospect, it's clear what it was the other way around, that the Bretton Woods thing was a ceiling on the price of gold. And that people, no one would be foolish enough to pay more than $35 an ounce for gold because they could just get it from the U.S. government or the Fed, whatever. So now it's tricky to figure out what went wrong there. And so I think the way I answered it last time, so there's at least two things going on. All right, so first of all, obviously anytime somebody says something economic, et cetera, is paribus, and other things were not equal. So when the U.S. government delinked from gold, they also, that gave the green light to run the printing press. And you could certainly see that the prices of everything rose at much faster rates during the 1970s than in previous decades. And so just because the actual number of dollar bills you had to turn over for an ounce of gold went up doesn't really refute Mises' point because, you know, they're printing dollars like crazy. Dollar price of everything went up. So really what you would want to do is to see, well, did gold – so my point is the issue wasn't really so much – gold versus the dollar, but more generally, gold is one commodity among millions of other commodities on planet Earth. The fact that gold has been singled out to be our money, and now it was no longer, that should have made the relative price of gold compared to other commodities go down. And so we can argue about the proper index to use, but that would have been a fairer test than just looking at gold against U.S. dollar bills. Because obviously that can be swamped by what happens if the number of U.S. dollar bills. I mean, by the same token, it could have just been the case. What if Richard Nixon went off the gold standard, and then for some reason the Fed jacked interest rates up to 50%, and they started shrinking the monetary base at 30% per year, and they did that for 20 years in a row. Well, then the dollar price of gold would go way down, but so would the dollar price of everything else, right? So, you know, if you're going to do massive changes in what you're doing with the quantity of dollar bills, that's not really a stable test. Okay, so, but having said all that, there's still a problem. Because, yeah, it's true, the dollar prices of just about everything went up during the 70s, except maybe the price of computer chips or something. But the price of gold went up a lot faster than the price of bread or the price of milk. Maybe not the price of oil. We'd have to go check that. But, and so there, you know, that's an issue. So the issue is when we say demonetize, really what we want to say is, I mean, to really capture the essence of Mises' monetary theory, as opposed to however he might have phrased it in reference to political actions, what we mean is, you know, where he's coming from, where it's sort of almost irrefutable, is to say, if a community originally is demanding a certain commodity to hold as a medium of exchange in addition to whatever its commercial applications are, and then if for some reason they stop holding that thing as a medium of exchange and now just desire it for its use as a commodity, well then, other things equal, it's got to be the case that its equilibrium exchange value is lower in the second scenario than in the first. You know, really, all you're saying is if the demand for something goes down, then its equilibrium price goes down. Other things equal, you know, and that's true, and you can't falsify that. And if you see something that doesn't look like it falsified, it's because other things must not be equal. So that's the way to rigorously capture what Mises is saying. Now, it's possible in the context when he said demonetization, he would have had in mind the government linking dollars to it. But I think clearly if you look at what happened in the 70s and beyond, it's not like people around the world all of a sudden said, oh, I guess gold isn't really useful anymore as a store of wealth or as a hedge against price inflation. No, when the U.S. government went off gold, I think that made people jump into gold even more, right? Because now, because before, some people could have been holding dollar-denominated assets thinking that was as good as holding gold. But then once Nixon severed the dollar's link to gold, now all of a sudden, no, I don't want to be holding dollar-denominated assets because who knows what crazy stuff the Fed's going to do. So I'm going to dump dollar-denominated assets and I'm going to get into physical gold. And so I think actually the demand for gold went way up because of Nixon's decision. And that's why you saw the huge thing. Just like the price of gold went way up when Ben Bernanke started doing his crazy stuff, even though the prices of other goods and services didn't go up nearly as much. Gold skyrocketed because for that segment of the population that saw what Bernanke was doing and said, that is going to kill the dollar, I sense a tidal wave of price inflation coming. What do? They want to get into something very liquid that will respond to price inflation, and the epitome of that is gold. And so that's why not everyone, but those people thinking like that rushed into gold and pushed up its price. So I don't know how Mises himself would have responded to you. I just kind of laid out a few different ways to make sure we're correctly framing the issue, but ultimately my response would be to say, in terms of the actual behavior of market participants, gold was not really demonetized. In the sense of, I mean, Oh, and there's one other thing too, because you can even check and you could look, did the stockpile of gold reserves in central banks around the world go down because of that decision? And I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer. I wouldn't bet $1,000 on the answer. I don't know, but that would be something to check. So there you go. That'd be the way I would answer that. But what is interesting is the similarity of those passages that you have seen in Mises' book, talking about the demonetization of gold and the reasoning of a lot of Keynesians. And the reason I didn't spell this out before, the reason I was hesitating to say Keynesian is I know Keynesians did say that, but for all I know, maybe a bunch of free market people did too. I don't know. So now I've read free market people who want to make fun of the Keynesians who were totally wrong about which way gold prices were going to go. And so they can go find, you know, so those quotes are authentic, I assume. So many prominent Keynesians did think gold was going to go down in the 70s, but for all I know, maybe a bunch of free market guys did it too. And I'm just not seeing that because I read free market websites that will make fun of Keynesians. I don't know. Okay. Chad Nelson says, unrelated to the class, how does the Mises Institute decide what books to reprint, study guides to commission, classes to offer, etc.? I don't know what the I don't know. There's a short answer because those aren't my decisions. The study guides that I did, I think they came and asked me. I mean, I probably made my general availability known to them or something, but I don't think any of the study guides that I said to them, hey, what if I wrote a study guide? And they said, oh, that sounds like a good idea. I'm pretty sure they said to me, you know, it would be good if we could do a study guide like this. Can you do it? I think that's the way it happened on all of them. And then I don't know when about the books to reprint, whatever. I really have no idea. Okay. Tom Miller, following up on that question, says, what other answer could be that the world has been off of gold as money since 1944, and some could argue much earlier than that? Well, I mean, Tom, I don't think that's, I mean, you could say that, but I don't think it's true. I mean, so even if that did help with what happened, I just don't think that is right. I mean, the U.S. was clearly, the dollar was still clearly tied to gold, and the other central banks in the world, it's true they were using the dollar now as their primary reserve asset, but that was only because it, in turn, was linked to gold. I mean, I guess I can't prove this to you, but I don't think Bretton Woods possibly could have been approved if the U.S. told the central banks of the world, we're not tying the dollar to gold, it's going to be fiat currency, and we want you to all use dollars, and let's all have now just a worldwide paper regime. I don't think that would have worked. I think they just would have said, no, that's crazy. We're going to just directly tie our currency back to gold or silver. So, I mean, I think even though it was a messed up system, I think Bretton Woods, you know, I think gold was still the world's money during the Bretton Woods system. And some could even argue that it is now. And I suppose, I don't know, this stuff, it all gets tricky. I'll grant you that. I mean, you couldn't go into the grocery store with a gold coin in 1970 and buy something unless it was a gold coin that was issued by the U.S. Mint, in which case, though, you would be silly to do that. You know, like if it was a $20 gold coin on a face value, but really it had a higher market value. Oh, actually, would they have the same market value? I had to research that. I'm not sure. If prior to 1971, something that was stamped such and such gold dollars, is that really how much gold was in it? I don't know. That might be the case. So maybe you could go in the grocery store and buy stuff with gold coins that were stamped by your government prior to then. But now, obviously, if you happen to have a thing that's a $20 and it's a gold coin, don't go buy something that's $20 with it because it's worth a lot more than that. Okay. Right, Tom says it was illegal for a U.S. citizen to own gold then. Right. So I guess the issue would be, yeah, you're right. I'm trying to think of. Okay, yeah. You're right, Tommy. It does get subtle. What does it mean to say was gold money? And I'm not sure. Because if you remember when Ron Paul and Ben Bernanke were going back and forth about his gold money, and of course, you know, the people on our side couldn't believe that Bernanke was. And I actually, don't tell anyone I said this, but I actually felt a little bit bad for Bernanke that, I mean, that was clearly a question designed to make him look bad in the sense, but there is a sense in which right now in the United States, gold isn't money and the U.S. dollar is, right? Like if you went to go sell something and the person tried to pay you in gold coins, you might object because unless you were planning on investing in gold coins right then, it's the same thing. You'd have to go sell them. You can't pay your utility bill with gold coins. You can't go to the grocery store with a gold coin right now unless, you know, you happen to know the manager. But the point is with all that stuff, you know, it's and that really, if you think about it, because people sometimes ask me, you know, how come the Mises Institute doesn't just switch to gold? You know, but, you know, if I were going to go give a talk and they were going to pay me, you know, they don't pay me a lot. Not that they're picking on me. They just, you know, they're a nonprofit. They don't pay tons of money for people to come give talks. But, you know, you go down there for Mises University, they pay us to do that. We don't just give up a week for nothing. And they give us checks denominated in U.S. dollars. And if they gave me some gold coins, I mean, that'd be kind of neat, but it'd be a pain, right? For one thing, I would be worried that the airport would try to confiscate them or something, and then when I got back home, I would probably have to go to a coin shop and sell it, and then, you know, lose the bid-ask spread or whatever. So just because chances are in my budget for that month, whatever I was going to get paid by them to go teach Mises University, I wasn't going to be able to save every last penny of that in the form of a gold coin. That I, you know, maybe I was going to have to spend some of it, you know, because that was part of my income that month that I was relying on to pay my bills. So you see the problem. So with all this stuff, it's and why is that the case? What if we're such huge gold bugs associated with the Mises Institute, and we all know the world would be so much better if everyone used gold? How come we don't just start doing it? And the answer is because not enough other people are doing it. It only makes sense to use something as a medium of exchange if everybody else is doing it. That's, you know, the whole, that's what a medium of, or, you know, that's what a money is. It's a universally accepted medium of exchange, right? So that's the thing. Okay. So Peter Serta is saying, if gold isn't liquid, doesn't that mean it isn't money? And they say, well, it's more due to transaction costs in general. Right, but that's the point, though. I mean, back, you know, forget the government. Just go back to the Mengarian story about how does gold emerge as the money, as the market's money of choice, and it's because of that snowball effect and whatever, and then it gets to the point where everybody's willing to accept gold. So if you had something else, the reason you would hesitate to accept it, even if it had a very high market value, is that there's transaction costs. Just like if somebody's going to pay me, you know, what if, I don't know, I can't think of an example. I'm going to sell my car, and then somebody offers to give me a yacht in exchange for it or a bunch of cash. Even if the yacht has a higher market value than the cash, I probably won't accept the yacht unless it's a huge difference because the yacht, there's tons of transaction costs. Okay, and then the last thing is, Tom Miller says, newsflash, Dr. Murphy agrees with Ben Bernanke. And against Ron Paul, just to make it even worse. So, but like I said, if you guys caught what happened there, when Tom Miller first said to me, since 1944, one could argue that the world had been off gold, I actually at first thought he was wrong. It's a weird situation where, clearly, let me just be clear in case those people don't get this. I think if the governments around the world stopped enforcing legal tender laws, got rid of capital gains taxes on precious metals and all the sorts of things, got rid of their central banks and whatever, I think pretty quickly gold would once again be the world's money. So that's partly what's driving this ambiguity here, is that we kind of have this sense that gold really should be the money, and it would be if actual market forces were allowed to operate. It's just they've all been systematically sabotaged. And so now we're in this weird sort of new equilibrium where everybody's using fiat money, even though that's a horrible money to be using. So that's why it's weird when you say, is gold money? I hesitate to just say yes or no, because there's an obvious sense in which, no, it's not. But then there's a pretty also compelling case to say, yes, it is money. Okay. One last quick question. Somebody asked me about how my son's basketball team did. They won one game. It was this last game of the season. So that was pretty cool. It was a tense game. Went down to the buzzer. They won 22-20. And that score is misleading because early on in the game, a kid from the other team got a defensive rebound and put it right back up. And so gave 2 points to my son's team because he scored on the wrong basket. And then that team ended up losing by 2 points. So there you go. Okay, guys, well, we're out of time. There are some pending questions here. It seems like most of them are not particularly relevant to the course, but if you do have something here that you really want me to hit, just post it on this, questions for the professor for week four, and I'll get them at some point. Okay, guys, thanks for tuning in, and then next week, starting, next week, these things will be earlier in the day, because now that league is done. All right, so long, guys.